And we're live with our 312th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Excited to be here as usual. Just a couple announcements before we dig into, you know, some of the tools and other things and news that we wanted to talk through today. First up, our training opportunities. I know I hit this pretty heavy every podcast, but we do want to make sure that you have the opportunity to attend these trainings as they are given. First one that's up is KernelCon, Harnessing LLMs for Application Security. That's the beginning of April. Towards the end of April, we have both Black Hat Asia and DEF CON Singapore. So those are both in Singapore. And are looking forward to that. The first one is the combination of LLMs, the Black Hat edition of both LLMs and secure code review. So learning how to do that and actually implement a LLMs to perform secure code review. And then we have another Harnessing LLMs for Application Security at DEF CON Singapore. Outside of that, Ken and I will also be hosting a panel at B-Side San Francisco. The State of Absolute AppSec, the same panel that we've done before. We will have Clint Gibler will be on. That'll be fun. I don't think we've had Clint on a panel before, Ken, if I remember right.
Nope.
And then Asta has agreed to join us. I think there is still a little bit of a question there given... Yeah, she hasn't necessarily accepted the full invitation yet, but she has said she will be available. So Asta Singhal from Netflix, who's awesome. We've done stuff with her for years. So excited to have her. And then the last person is Kevin McDermott from Superhuman, the head of security over there. It'll be an interesting panel. I mean, we'll go over quite a few things, mainly just around, you know, what's happened in the last year. Feels like, you know, even the last 2 months would be enough to talk about for hours and hours, given OpenClaw and the state of AI and AppSec, right? Like that seems to be what the podcast has evolved to recently, but it's just because it's the elephant in the room. I mean, before AI, we talked a lot about, I don't know, SCA tools and supply chain, and those are all still issues that I'm sure will come up on the panel. Ken just posted the link to a happy hour after the B-Sides San Francisco event. Actually, this is part of RSA. That is Monday night at RSA. Dry Run, Red Point, and Rad Security are going to be hosting a happy hour. For podcast listeners, other industry people that will be there. We'll be talking about whatever you want to. Please join us, request to join. We do have a limited space, right? Like none of these spaces are massive, but please sign up. We'd love to see you down there when we're in San Francisco. Outside of that, Ken, is there anything else that I'm missing? Here, let me drop the training link in there as well.
Okay, so we talked about KernelCon, Singapore, Black Hat and DEF CON. We talked about RSA and the B-Sides SF stuff. My goodness. Yeah.
Next couple months are going to be busy.
Yeah, it's heating up again. That's that time of year where we're getting ready for all the conference travel. And I was really enjoying, frankly, I am enjoying just being at home. I'm going to try, I think this year I'm really going to make a concerted effort to travel less. How about you? What are you thinking for this year?
We just had our company offsite or onsite, whatever you want to call it nowadays, right? Like, you know, what do we want to do in 2026? And part of that was because we had people down at CactusCon doing a workshop. But it was a great thing, right? Like I couldn't actually make the workshop because I had family commitments over the weekend, or I couldn't make it down to CactusCon. It's the first time in a few years that I've missed because it really is a regional conference for me down in Arizona. It would have been great to catch up with people, but a similar thing, right? I just, like, I'm realizing I can't travel every 2 to 3 weeks and really keep my sanity, right? Because it just disrupts your normal, your normal schedule, your normal routine, like all the things that you like to do, becomes a little bit more difficult. So I'm trying to kind of target these periods where, yeah, we're going to travel, like, you know, March, April is probably going to be pretty heavy. And then I'm going to need a couple months off before we have to go back to the Vegas routine, right? That I know is coming up as well between, you know, Black Hat USA, DEF CON, B-Sides LV, like all of those conferences that happen. And so trying to target more like strategic. But it was also good to actually see my team go out and do things necessarily, not necessarily like me having to be the one to do it, right? Just kind of like, oh, it was one of those, the company's grown a little bit. And you know, there's other people that can handle some of that, so it doesn't have to always be the same person or the same people that are traveling. So it's kind of a shared experience rather than, you know, one person completely just getting burnt out on travel and, you know, sales type activities.
I know, like, as time goes on, as growth happens, I probably won't have to do the booth work as much, but like, I've kind of learned to almost really enjoy that booth experience, but maybe just for one day, not for all days of a conference. But it is like, I don't know why I thought about that, but yeah, that's like one thing. If I'm not traveling as much, I might actually miss a little bit. But beyond that, I don't know, man, the last few years have been a lot of travel for me. So I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever. It's what you said, like strategic and for a specific reason and not just, you know, trying to go everywhere and raise awareness about the company and all that stuff, you know, all the time.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting dilemma, right? At times, because you do want to be out there. You want to be talking to people. It's a space that, you know, obviously, like we love, right? Like, you know, podcast is a labor of love. It's not necessarily something that we're looking to get, you know, earn a ton amount of money from or anything like that. And so I'm always going to go talk about this stuff, right? Like it, you know, it doesn't feel like it's just a part of life. And that's honestly my favorite part is usually the interactions that we have with people, seeing other people that are excited, seeing people as they're coming into the space and realizing what can be done, or, you know, when we're training and that light bulb goes off for people on how many possibilities are in front of them, how to actually go about doing, you know, these things. That's the great part about it. But a lot of times it's like, you know, you think about the travel that it takes, right? Like the time that it takes to get out of everything, the time that it, you know, traveling to Europe, traveling to, you know, Singapore for this, right? Like it's really hard on your body, especially as you get older, right? So you got to kind of plan around what's the most effective and where you're going to be, I guess, happiest, but also able to communicate ideas and meet people where it makes the most sense. So,
yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, as a clearly young, sprightly, in his 20s guy, I don't have to deal with the age. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have to deal with that.
Maybe mentally I'm still there.
Yeah.
I was going to mention something else, like, because I don't normally promote these things, but I'm actually really excited. I get to do a webinar with, so I've always been a big fan of Jonathan Cran, or Jay Cran, as we all know him. Especially if you are like a Metasploit person at any time, you definitely know the name. In any case, I get to do a webinar with him where we talk about like what are security reviews like, and how do you actually accomplish those in today's like vibe coding centric world. So I am excited about that. And I did put the link in there in case you want to register, just because, like, yeah, I actually think that's going to be really fun and provide a lot of value. So if you want to go to that one, put the link in there.
Yeah. No, that'd be a good one. I did see that one pop up in the feed and was super interested, just because it is you and Jay Cran. And then also the topic. Yeah.
It's so fun because every time that I get on a call with him, like, because we met like a week or two ago, and you know, he was giving me some, I think we were going back and forth about not because we did do a meeting about the webinar, but we did something about, I don't know, something else technical. I think it was something to do with like skills and Claude and things like that. Anyways, it was really, really fun. And yeah, I just walk away, you know, how you have conversations with somebody and you kind of walk away and you're like, all right, cool. I'm kind of inspired to do stuff again.
Yep.
Yeah. That's how I see him. So.
Sweet. Pretty nice. Yeah. Yeah. Looking forward to that one. The other idea that I was pitched recently, and I know we're just kind of all over today, like, you know, we'll get to some of these tools here shortly, but another idea that, you know, has been bouncing around, and I think Aaron on my team was talking about it, like, was this idea that we could do a, like, some sort of a security review or After Dark episode where we analyzed a vibe coded application, right? So if we went off and gave OpenClaw or whatever else, right, like, hey, you know, Claude, I need you to go build me this application that does X, Y, and Z. And then take a look at the output to see, you know, from a secure code review perspective, from an analysis perspective, what it actually put together, as opposed to doing like the open source code basis that we've done in the past. But, you know, what is it that a vibe coded application actually generates? And I like, and in general, like, that's, you know, doing these security reviews, like, what we have to watch out for with a vibe coded application. I've been thinking about like what we need to do from a refresher perspective when we talk about secure code reviews. And even if we're having like AI agents go and do the secure code reviews for us, how, like, what are the gotchas? What are the things that AI agents and vibe coded applications are bad at that, you know, right now we typically key off of things in application code or in source code that is related to the person that was actually developing that application. But AI agents are going to have different preferences. They're going to have different output that we wouldn't necessarily see from a human coder. So what does that look like, right? Like, I, and this is an honest question to you, like, what would you start to look for? So, and just an example here, right? Like, when we're looking at things like comments, for, you know, we're typically we're looking for things where developers are frustrated, right? Swear words, right? Like, you know, just like other signs of frustration in comments and code, which could point us to weaknesses, but that's not something that an AI agent would necessarily push into comments. That being said, some of the thought process that goes into what an AI agent is developing and putting into the comments might also be just as indicative of security flaws that we're going to need to actually take a look at. And so there's a difference in how that analysis needs to happen because it is an AI or vibe coded application versus what actually is coming from a human. I mean, is that something that you've thought about at all? I mean, obviously, like, as you're pulling it, you know, you're developing a product around, you know, code reviews and using AI agents to identify that. Have you seen anything like from a vibe code perspective that you would call out as, hey, this is definitely vibe coded and this is why, and this is sort of the vulnerabilities that we look for in those applications as opposed to the human developed ones?
Sorry, my audio cut out. Somebody, just real briefly, OSX did this update now where, like, if someone calls my phone, my audio cuts out because now it's on my laptop. So I need to change that. Anyways, yeah. That's a new thing that was going to happen. So what was the last part of what you said?
Oh, okay. So in developing a secure code review product, right, or a SaaS product.
Sure.
Have you seen, well, no, not have you seen, because I know you have seen. What are the differences that you see in code from an AI agent versus a human developed application?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. So I think that the main things that I see that go wrong anyways are, well, actually good and bad. So good is I do tend to see, depends on the model, depends on the tool, but a lot of times there's good effort put towards testing, whereas, you know, plenty of humans will ship code with no tests. So that right away. And actually just building tests for the functionality, even if you like manually wrote that code, that's like a positive thing that they're doing. Negatives, though, I can tell you, like, this is just very basic. I was building a Ruby on Rails app API, and I had already put in, instituted some authorization at the base level controller. And yeah, like, for instance, I was adding some endpoints, and, you know, it was like, hey, make sure you respect that, those settings and whatever. I had to explicitly say that. In one instance, they didn't even respect those settings and didn't infer what the point of those, that authorization function was, and basically multiple times wrote code that didn't, it factored in like maybe a higher level authorization. We've talked about this before. Humans do it too, where they factor in like, oh, I don't know, are you an admin? Great. But are you an admin on that resource that you're updating, for instance? And so it was making those kinds of mistakes where it didn't understand, like, even though I explicitly told it about this authorization function, it didn't really factor in how that thing worked, didn't really care so much about it, created a controller that didn't even inherit from the base controller, by the way, in one instance. So it didn't even get those protections. In other instances, like I said, factored in the authorization function, but didn't factor in the discrete resources that were being updated. So I see that all the time. That's a common one. So like weird authorization patterns, but it's not really like, that's how it manifests, is like an authorization or a security issue. But this is true of just like Claude or Codex or anything in general, which is that they tend to forget about certain parts of the code base that are already tackling. I've said this before, mm-hmm. that are already doing something. But when that, like, so imagine there's a util class that's built, and they just create another utils class because they didn't know that utils class was already there, for instance, right? And, you know, and that sucks too, because there's real money involved. It's not just like security or functionality. You're spending tokens for crap work, right? You're just spending tokens on nothing. So that's money lost, time lost, all that. But on top of that, I'd say, like, lately our engineers are noticing that, so Opus 4.6 came out, and everybody yep. was like, oh man, you gotta try Opus 4.6, blah, blah, blah. Great for a minute. And then the last couple days, our team has seen some huge degradations in performance. One of the reasons they suspect is that something changed with how Anthropic themselves are prompting Opus, like at the system prompt level. Okay. Because that's one theory. I don't know what the real reason is, but internally, my engineers are talking about, like, maybe that's why it's not really listening to superpowers, because it seems like it's not listening to the superpower guidance, so that it performs how it's supposed to perform. So in this latest model update, they basically tried to, this is the one problem with frontier models, they're trying to do it all. And that's really, really hard. You can't do it all and be successful and great at any one thing. That's just true of life. That's true of anything. It's really, really hard. So they're not doing well in everything. And like I said, we're actually seeing our team try to revert back to 4.5. And I remember reading this morning, one of our engineers had said that the planning, like it did some sort of planning phase. And then it like shifted itself over to 4.6 for that planning phase by default, instead of staying on 4.5. So like there are some significant, I mean, beyond the issue with AI companies and, like, you know, money and how to generate enough revenue and prices increasing. I mean, we saw a 2x increase in cost for Gemini between 2.5 and 3. And now I'm just going on rants, by the way. So it's not, I need to bring this back in. So long story short, your original question, I've gone way outside the boundaries of, which is just, what kind of things are you seeing? But that is what I'm seeing in the real world. I'm seeing it just a lot of maybe problems with just not checking out enough of the code base or referencing enough of the right Claude.md or skills or whatever to get to the right place.
Okay. Well, and that's it, right? Like those are the sorts of gotchas that are new, right? Like, and to be completely honest, right, like secure code review, like what the process that we've been following, the methodology that we've come up with for a manual secure code review over the last 15, 20 years hasn't changed that much, right? The patterns that we look for, you know, the approach itself, the methodology is going to be sound, whether it's like AI produced or human produced code. But the patterns that we're looking for are going to change. Like it just expanded exponentially because of the amount of code that's being generated. And I'm thinking back to this weekend, right? Like, you know, if anyone watched the Super Bowl, the ads that were generated or that were created for the Super Bowl, you know, half of them were AI companies, it seemed like, right? You had a few that were, you know, hey, you know, you're an accountant at this company. Guess what? You can create your own app for things now, right? Like you don't even need developers anymore. And just like, oh, and then you give it access to the customer list and you give it access to all of your finances and right, like, yeah, nothing could ever go wrong there, right? It's just, to me, it's fascinating that that's the sales pitch that we're giving people, because it is, I mean, I get it. They want you to come and use their service to actually create applications, but all of the dangers, the sharp edges to actually doing that are being swept under the rug. Because just for the fact that they need to make money because they are an AI company and people need to come and actually use their service, right? And I think back to the cloud, right? I think back to shadow IT, the fact that so many engineers and other people actually started deploying applications and code and other things to the cloud before it was fully baked and before we actually created any sort of security around those environments. There was just huge breaches and other things that actually happened. And we're going to see the same thing. We're going to see a continuation that in this AI space as people use these different services to actually create applications and to accomplish tasks, because we don't have the same level of security controls built into any of it yet. Yeah.
I mean, I think like there's good and bad. You know, the good is that the good is that you've democratized, I guess, and lowered the entry for barrier. So you do get, I'll say this, you do, like, I think more ideas are always a good thing. Well, doesn't mean they always have the best outcomes, but I say that tongue in cheek. I really do think, like, yes, now there are more people who have some pretty great ideas that it'll be a little bit more accessible for them to build things. I also think it'd be nice for, like, you know, in the modern times that resumes are great, but I think having your own personal, in fact, I need to do that with mine. I haven't updated mine in like a decade, but I need to do that, but myself, but like personal websites, like if you're branding yourself, you know, which is important, especially in our line of work, this industry specifically. But I think a lot of people in general, you know, in many industries, they need to brand themselves. So that's good. And then one thing I think that's really interesting to me too is just this notion of like Salesforce and other companies who charge exorbitant, and not to say they don't deserve to charge that, but they do. They charge exorbitant amounts of money for licenses. And I think those are replaceable. Let's be honest. Those are going to be replaceable. And I think you see that when you look at the stock market and the several hundred billion that got wiped off the map.
Yeah.
So in any case, I don't know where I'm going with that. We know things are changing. Just keeping an eye on it week to week. The downside is, if you think like here's what I can say. You can build something really quickly and really well and get things off the ground. I will tell you, if you work professionally and as a professional engineering group with multiple people on a code base and you're scaling and or not scaling shipping sorry at a high velocity, things break down and you end up having to do a lot of managing of the way that you're using those tools. And like even internally right now, we've mentioned today where we had like this weird, why is it switching to 4.6 and things aren't working well and all that. It's like, there's upkeep. There's upkeep with all of this. That's the one thing I will say, is that these companies don't tell you that part of it, which is the part of it is that there is a cost associated with vibe coding or AI generated code. You just don't see it until a little ways, a little further down, and then you start to see it. And then it's like, oh crap, I need to correct an instrument, yada, yada, yada. And then you do that, and then something new ships in a, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and then that changes everything again. And so there is an upkeep cost, and it's very frequent upkeep. I guess that'd be the downside.
Yeah.
And so if you think just put a junior in there and they're going to understand how to handle it in 3 months when they're at that point, or 2 months or whatever, like, you're wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just like, it's all happening so quickly. Right. So I do think this is going to be an interesting exercise for us. Right. Like, so after you get through your security reviews webinar with Jay Cran, we're going to create a couple of applications. I mean, we'll use a different, this will be the other thing, is I think we'll use different services for that, right? Like, so we'll use Claude, we'll use Codex, we'll use, you know, whatever. We'll identify a couple of them to create an application, and then actually go in and review the source code that's being generated to see what, you know, what actually is being done, how much code's being generated, what the gotchas are. Because I mean, part of this is selfish, right? Like, we need to learn how these systems are thinking. And then, but then to your point, right? The sooner that these foundational models, or the more that they upgrade these foundational models, they change the behavior over time. And so what Sonnet or what Opus is generating right now could be different in 2 weeks when they bump that version and they introduce different guardrails, they introduce different training material into it, right? Like, whatever that is, it's really difficult to keep a handle on what the current best use case, what the current best standard or just use pattern should actually be. So yeah, watch out for that, because yeah, you and I will talk about it offline, but I think it could be a really interesting, even just talk, right?
Yeah, I think it'd be fun. Put out a list of parameters for what needs to be built, and then try it out in different tools, different tech stacks, and see what happens. Yeah. I already know what's going to happen, but because I've been there. Been there is what I mean, like, for a while. So
yeah, I know. I realize that. Yeah, it'd just be like sharing some of that, like, crossover that we're seeing in what the patterns look like. So,
yeah,
cool. On top of that, like, the articles, let me see, like, the first one that I wanted to call out, let's see, like, we'll do tools first, right? We got three that were interesting to me that just popped up over the last couple of days, just on my radar, whether that's like through Reddit or, you know, TLDRSec or whatever else. But the first one I wanted to talk about was TrapSec, right? And I wanted your opinion on this, and I'll drop it into Slack here as well. Okay, so TrapSec is basically a framework for adding canary API endpoints to your application that will notify you when you're being scanned. So similar to the idea of a honeypot, or, you know, canary tokens, that if you see them being used, you know that something malicious or unintended is actually happening, right? It's a framework that's been built. It builds like decoy routes in a number of languages and frameworks, so including Python, Node, and Go. But then we'll basically integrate with your SIM to notify you when those API endpoints are actually triggered by an unknown actor, whether they've been malicious or just scanning your application. Have you deployed anything similar to this in the past, like honeypots, or, you know, even just like canary tokens?
No, I have not. Actually, this is the one area that I have never explored. Never.
Okay. It's an interesting use case to me, right? Like, from a, you know, a SOC perspective, a monitoring perspective, a logging perspective, I like this idea, right? Like, you know, I've always, I've seen it be effective in multiple organizations that, you know, these sorts of canary tokens and other things allow you to know when you're being targeted. That being said, this specific project is integrating directly with your application, right? So you are adding routes, you are adding actual content and attack surface into your application. That gives me a little bit of pause, just from a threat perspective. The fact that I'm introducing again more routes into my code base and integration points and availability triggers, that starts to become a concern to me, right? Especially high performant applications. Do you really want to add additional overhead for, you know, specific API endpoints that'll do this sort of thing? I would be interested realistically in something similar to this. It would be deployed as, you know, a separate Lambda, right, in AWS or something like that, rather than in my custom code. That's the only thing here that starts to, you know, feel a little bit off to me, because it does. There is basically, what am I trying to get at here? There's additional risk and additional overhead that could be a negative to actually deploying something like this within your application.
Yeah, I mean, everything you just said, developers hate when you introduce anything, especially mm-hmm. anything that introduces latency, extra routes, really anything at all. They don't like, they're just very, in my experience anyways, there tend to be, I don't want to say like, it's not like, I don't mean it like a rude way, but it's like, no, I need to vet what's going into my application code base, which is great. Should act like that. But yeah, so yeah, I don't. So how does this work? Is that it's embedded inside of the application, has decoy routes. And the idea is that somebody is going to try and probe. I mean, like, what's the value? I'm not being critical. I'm actually curious. What's the value of knowing that someone's, because we get, I think like any company gets probed all day long. I know that. Like I put an application online, and I swear to you, it felt almost instantly, but it was like not long, because I had to review logs. I imagine you deploy something and like you're, you know, maybe sending some more pull requests because you're just getting this thing online. And so you have to like, oh, okay, I didn't get this permission right, so I'll do this, or maybe I need to submit another pull request for Terraform to change something, whatever, right? Okay, so imagine you get done through all of those. So it has been online long enough to like technically be online, but it's not really fully online. It's not really, you know, nobody knows about this but you. Well, that was my situation, and I swear to God, as soon as I put it online, boom, I'm just watching attack. I was watching logs to see if like the deployment was working, and I'm seeing attack strings come across. I was mm-hmm. like, wow, that was quick. That was brutal. Like, I haven't even really deployed this thing fully. Nobody even knows it's online except for the DNS record I just created. And like, it's already getting hammered. So I'm saying all that to say, like, I just assume that I'm getting hammered all day long. So what's the value in this is my question.
Yeah. So the thinking behind it, right, in general, canary tokens and, honeypots is, number one, it will slow down an attacker on actually what is valid for an application, right? So it gives you more time to respond. There's that. Number two is, especially when it's embedded deeper in an application, you know when somebody's attempting something malicious. Now, if it's like directly on the perimeter with a, you know, anonymous access, the likelihood that it's going to trigger and actually like overwhelm your SOC is higher, right? It just is. But if I can talk myself into this, if I was deploying an API that was authenticated and there were routes in there that only existed, like say in the Swagger file, right, that were never actually used by the application. If all of a sudden I start to get request to those decoy routes from an authenticated account, that could be an indication that, hey, maybe the account has been compromised, that one of my customers is doing something malicious, right? Like if there is at least some barrier to entry to getting to those API endpoints, that's where it becomes more useful to me because the signal to noise ratio increases. If it's just an API that's out on your WAF or whatever it is that, you know, or is publicly accessible and that Swagger file is open, it's in your sitemap, the likelihood that it's actually going to be hit is so incredibly high that I would question the value, right? Because all you're going to have to do is filter that noise out in addition to everything else. But I think that's what they're trying to get to, is these API endpoints where it's a high fidelity signal that an attack or malicious behavior is going on, and it gives you time to respond because you know quicker that you're being profiled.
I like really this. I'm reading their docs, and they talk about how to like set up baiting. They literally have a section called baiting and lures, so that's pretty cool. Like I get it now. So the idea is that you give them these breadcrumbs of things that don't exist and make things seem like realistic. Give them, if they're unauthenticated, give them the 401, make it clear like that endpoint requires authentication, and then wait till they're authenticated, see which account they're using or that they've compromised or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. But I will say this, here's the other thing too. Like I talk to a lot of security programs just like you do. And these days I get the sense that like, people don't, I feel like they're treading water. They're not really like head above water. And this is kind of like an initiative style of work, not a keep the lights on KTLO kind of work. And I feel like a lot of teams are stuck in the KTLO life right now. I don't know why that is. I don't know, but that is where it's where the conversations, I mean, I don't meet a lot of people. I guess I'm saying I don't meet a lot of people that have the ability to implement these kind of initiatives, but it's really neat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would imagine this would be coming more from like your SOC. If they are chasing those breadcrumbs, right? If you're not doing the basics of logging and everything else, this is way, way, way down on the list of priority. Right. And I'm with you. I think the industry in general is very stretched at the moment, between layoffs, between cutbacks, between the amount of code that's being generated, the number of developers or people that think they're developers now, just keeping a handle on what your assets are in any organization at this point is a difficult and almost Herculean task. People are going to, again, shadow IT, right? Like new AI generated applications. They're using their personal devices to get access to company data, whatever. And then they're creating new applications. So AppSec and ProdSec has just expanded. And you still only have the same two guys that are on your team that are trying to cover everything, in addition to the past, like, pen tests and vulnerability management and noise that's coming in from your SEA and your traditional DAST and SAS tools. And they haven't necessarily adapted yet to AI, and utilizing AI in that pipeline to help them. And so they're just overwhelmed. And that's where gaps actually occur. That's where most applications are hit. We were talking about it recently that, most of the breaches that have happened or that have ever happened are against applications and companies that were in compliance with whatever regulations they're under, right? So we go back to the Target breach, right? Years and years ago, Target was breached. People got access to all of the systems that were doing the point of sale systems, got credit cards. They were pulling off just plain text credit cards. Target at the time was so-called compliant to PCI, right? They had been audited, and one of the compliance metrics that they have in there is that you encrypt credit card numbers at point of sale before it's actually passed through the system, right? But it wasn't. They weren't actually doing that. There was plain text credit card numbers on all of these systems that the attackers took. So since then, you know, it's been a continuation of this. And why does that happen, right? Typically, it's the blind spots that we have from the current tool sets that's out there. It's fatigue, right? The security fatigue. I know that's not necessarily something that we were going to talk about today. I know it's kind of popped up. You know, there's been a couple of posts recently I've seen on LinkedIn talking through this, that there is, right, like the security teams are so overwhelmed. Yeah.
Like Caleb's post, because that's a good post to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, let me grab it here. I'll throw it up there. So Caleb Seema posted. I saw it because Jason posted as well, right? But let me drop the link in.
Yeah, Haddix. Yeah.
Yep, yep. Yeah. AI is not your biggest threat, right? Or your biggest risk. Let me just put that up on the screen so I can actually like talk through it. Yeah, AI is not your biggest security risk. Your exhausted security team is. I don't think we can read through the rest of it, right? But that is the takeaway. Yes, AI is the hot thing right now. And we're really concerned about vibe-coded applications. I mean, you and I have been talking about that, right? Like, but if your security team doesn't have the capacity to actually do what they're currently supposed to be doing, or right, like the SOC hasn't been trained properly or whatever it is, the likelihood that you're going to catch an AI security risk on top of that is just incredibly low. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing is like, yes, the threats have changed and there's lots of change and we're all keenly aware of that. But the one thing that really hasn't changed is the burnout. I mean, that really has been, that's been like that for just about forever. I've talked about it before. You've talked about it before. There's lots of different reasons why this happens. But, you know, going through some of like, instead of us, you know, our take, I mean, trying to see if there's like a good list, summarized list by someone other than us, because I see all the people we know have commented, right? We know Sean Moyer pretty well, Chris Hughes, Jason Haddix, you know, talked to all these people before. I don't see a lot of like an explanation on why that is. I see like different people's sort of like, you know, I use OKR based descoping and I use this other technique and all that stuff, and it's like that's all great and well and fine. A lot of people are just kind of agreeing as I'm scrolling through this.
Yeah.
But like, there's a lot of reasons why this happens. That's the thing, is there's not really like, you can give your take on how you've, you know, sort of fixed this in your organization, but there's just so many reasons this could happen. This could happen simply because you have just a crappy manager, and like, that's nothing to do with security. It's just, you have a crap manager who's just making your life miserable. That could be because you have a dysfunctional organization. It has, again, nothing to do with security. Probably other people in that same organization feel that way. But if like, you know, priorities shift constantly, there's, you know, no recognition of, you know, churn, and there's no clear, like all the bad things, right? Bureaucracy, overly codifying processes, you know, I had a situation where I had like I was put in a weird situation where I really didn't get anything that basically I was notified as a middle manager of really bad policy changes, you know, as they happened and were distributed to the same people that report to me with no time to myself process and deliver that message and, you know, whatever. And so like, you could point to a million things that you could look at to make an organization dysfunctional. So you could have a dysfunctional manager, dysfunctional organization. You could have the feeling of people just don't care. You know, I put out these things and I do these things and it just doesn't seem like anybody cares. It could be that you've lost staffing. You know, there's just, I feel like there's a million reasons for why teams could have issues, and they don't, a lot of them don't have anything to do with security, right? Like the job's the job. It's tough. Yeah. And like, of course, you know, we're often pulled into even as people I would say AppSec typically does a lot of planned work, or should be doing a lot of planned work. But you know, even that niche or that security entity does a lot of unplanned work. So I don't know. It's just it's nice to raise it. It's very, very true. With limited exceptions, I'm not sure that it really has anything to do specifically with the job.
No,
I don't know that it doesn't have to do with the job, right? It could be organized, like, yeah. So it's a hard thing to unpack, basically. But burnout is real. Well, I do think that any team that consistently does keep the lights on work, KTLO work only, are going to be the ones that burn out the fastest. That's my opinion. But what do you think? I mean, am I wrong? Is it security inherently so different that, you know, we uniquely have burnout, or what?
I think the pressures do lead to a higher rate of burnout at times, but with the caveat that other teams also experience similar things, right? I got a really good friend. It's like, he's been like middle manager, kind of like of development orgs for years and years. And, you know, he's dealing with a layoff again right now. And it feels like he, you know, because he is in middle management, he's hopped jobs every like 2 to 3 years trying to build development teams at various organizations. But being in that middle management layer, he's not like in the decision process, but he's also not the cog in the wheel that's actually cutting code. And so his job is constantly a risk. So the stress level there and the burnout there is also very high, right? And like anytime that there is significant pressure on a person or on a team to actually produce, whether that's security, whether that's development, whether that's finance, you're going to see a higher level of burnout because people have to deal with stress, and people deal with stress in different ways. One of the ways that they deal with stress is saying, screw it, I'm out, right? Or I give up hope and I just do the bare minimum so that I can get through the day, and I lose my passion. So
Actually not, if externalized, that's actually the healthier option, because at least somebody can recognize it and turn it around. That's not that person. It's the one that's more nefarious to me is the silent sort of withdrawal,
burnout.
You know, right. You just see less produced. The one-on-ones there's not as much magic there or spark. There's not connection the same way. You know, you'll see like in team meetings, cameras start to go off and people start to be very disconnected. And that's like that's the harder one. And as like, I feel like as a manager, you're constantly trying to understand where people are at in that way. Like if you're a good manager and trying to read them, and because that's the one that's the worst. I would love it if somebody comes to me and is like, hey, I'm burnt out, and I'm just going to tell you that. It's like, great, all right, that I can work with. Let's talk about a plan to fix it. It's the people don't say anything, and it just sort and if that person is also like, the other worst part about that is if that person is silently withdrawing and they're the leader, well then you have a situation where everybody might start to like. Silently,
the whole team,
draw from work, and it's not like, you know, it's not I don't care about my role. That's the problem, is I too care too much almost about my role, and I don't feel like, you know, I hear a lot of things. I feel like powerless to make change. That's a big one. I don't feel like I have agency and autonomy. That's another one. Not feeling valued is a big one. You know, I think the one thing unique to security is that we are a cost center. We are not seen as a producer of anything that, you know, makes money. It takes a pretty mature executive team to, which isn't the case everywhere, right? To acknowledge that security does have a place and does need adequate funding and does need adequate attention and should be, and more than that, should be a part of, you know, everything like development processes, you know, engineering work, if it's compliance based or even legal, like being dialed in and connected at the right moments, you know, it's not just executive sponsorship in a feel good way. It's like literally making sure that concrete example would be, like I've mentioned many times on the podcast, how GitHub would pull their engineering leaders in every week and say, okay, this is where we're at with services that are out of SLA. And I know we have an article about scorecarding, and scorecarding was definitely not security scorecarding, but other kinds of scorecarding, in addition to some security scorecarding metrics, were placed on those services. And every time that service was seen as, you know, slipping towards unhealthy, like called on the carpet, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do now to fix this, so that by the next meeting, this isn't still the case? So that's active, you know, actively engaged in the success of security from an executive sponsorship perspective. But that just doesn't exist everywhere. And so I understand why there are times where things like that, like, yes, it's a security specific thing because we have to be connected, but we do cost you money. And we do tend to, if we don't do our jobs right, slow you down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I keep going back to this concept that the biggest risk that we have is usually not technical risk, it's people risk, right? Across the board. So any organization, the breaches that happen typically come from, you know, okay, so it could be burnout, but it's typically people, right? The fact that, you know, social engineering engagements are so effective. That people are distracted, people have personal concerns, people have other things that are going on. And I'm not talking just security, I'm talking just your general, you know, any worker of an organization that has credentials and has the ability to access, you know, private or confidential information is a target. All that we've done with AI is increased the surface of that target. So instead of social engineering, now we have prompt engineering, and we have other ways of going at it, right? That doesn't discount what exactly what you're talking about from a leadership perspective and security in general. Security will be a bigger target and has more inherent risk within it than your general like worker population. And that's wholly due to the role that they fill for an organization and the access that they have. Just like your executives, right? Like the fact that they are out there, they're on LinkedIn, they are going to be targets of phishing campaigns and vishing and everything else that goes into that because of the access that they have to money and to confidential secrets and everything else for an organization. And so we're expanding that out to, you know, security people. So you have to recognize when they actually have some sort of burnout. You have to recognize that this is going to happen. And you know, you've got to find the people that are resilient and communicative about their own personal hangups, their own personal burnout cycles or whatever it is, or you have to actually be able to monitor for that. What?
Or just recognize that they may not tell you that and keep an eye on
yeah.
it. Like people, so a lot of people have a lot of pride and they don't want to share those things. And so you have to draw it out of them. And that's why I say, like, I think it's as much on the people that are the managers as the individuals themselves. It's obviously the individual's responsibility first, but I would equally say, again, as a manager, you can't just like wait, you got to keep an eye on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I mean, and that could be a whole other podcast episode at some point, right? Just talking about how to effectively manage burnout, I guess, right? Like personally, but also as a manager. Because I know you and I struggle with it. And like even on a day-to-day basis, right? Like there's days that the morning is great and everything's going well. And then something happens and all of a sudden, like I just want nothing to do with, you know, anything AppSec, right? Like it just, you know, this happens over and over again in the cycle of being in this industry. And maybe, you know, it's so quick right now, the turnaround on news and what's going on, development, you know, in your organization can actually change day to day, which can cause higher levels of context switching. And the, you know, just there's all sorts of stuff that goes into, you know, personal burnout versus like seeing that in team members. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
It's not easy to always detect, but I think we've given hopefully some good,
yeah,
some good signs. We don't have a ton, by the way. So I'm not sure. Was there sorry to switch, but just to, for the interest of time, do we have, like, I know you had a couple other tools. We got some other articles. Was there anything that you really, really were drawn to discuss today?
Yeah. Do you want to talk? You dropped that one article. Where did that go? I'm looking for it now.
Sorry. The security score thing.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the security scorecarding? That's from Rami, right?
Sure. Yeah, I think
let's talk about that quick. I'll put that. Yeah, I'll get the rest of those articles into, like, the newsletter, or, you know, we'll drop them out this week. But yeah, so Rami Mack, scorecarding. This article is from last year, right? But he talks about. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry. Do you want me to show it? Where do you want to start with this one?
Yeah, can you put it up on the screen and I can kind of talk? Yeah, so it's just kind of like what he did was he aggregated. I know it's an old article, but I came across it today, so I don't care. It's new to me, so whatever. So, but I thought it was cool because what he did is he actually put together a bunch of different. So, like, we had Chime on the podcast before. I don't remember the episode, but you can look at our YouTube channel and you can see that we had the Chime engineers on to discuss Monocle and not just the tool, obviously the secure scorecarding tool, but also like the principles behind it. And so he talks about sort of like, I guess if I was to distill down the things that he saw as valuable out of there, it's like tactical fixes, all of them, sort of are doable and achievable by engineers. And then leaders can observe the entire health of the entire program. At kind of like a, I don't remember if it was a team or a repo level view, and it might've been both, but in any case, it gives a view of like risk, health, and things of that nature. And also gives a path to actually improving your score. And if I'm not mistaken, I also thought they might have put a bit of gamification into it when we talked to them through, I want to say there was maybe like a, on the, you know how like you can do on the readmes, you can have like a passing score on something. And I do believe that they had that implemented as well in the readmes where you actually had their scorecard grade in the readme. So you could see actively the repo's health. So I thought that was really neat. He broke down Netflix's crack at this. What's interesting is he even introduced GitHub's. And what's really funny about GitHub's fundamentals program is like, I was with that team when that was like sort of coming off the ground. And so I'm like deeply familiar with the concept of engineering fundamentals at GitHub and security scorecarding and actually the journey to that. And I can tell you it's very much aimed at the same kinds of outcomes that Chime basically was going for as well. I think there's a lot of overlap between GitHub and Chime. Netflix is a little different. They do have scorecarding and what have you. And they also, like, actually that was the first program I've ever heard of doing scorecarding. And it was at Jason Chan's Netflix AWS talk in maybe like 2014, 2015, 2016, something like that timeline wise. I don't really remember. Yeah. And so he was talking about how it was like, it's depending on how you sort of look at it, it's either a wall of shame or a wall of pride, right? And but everybody can see where you fall on that board. And he talks about Segment/Twilio, but then he has his takeaways, and I figure we can kind of go over those real quick before we sign off for the podcast. So I'll just pick one that I think is maybe really important. Well, actually, you know, I'm not sure if the, okay, well, I don't see the one that I was, there was something that he wrote, maybe it was above it somewhere, but basically what the value I see in this is that it's not just It's not just like, hey, you have a outdated CV in your code. It's a lot of things they're taking into account. There's a lot of health metrics and security metrics. And I think like when you do that, when you combine multiple metrics, you get a holistic picture of the just overall health, whether it's security or otherwise, of that application. And I think making that very clear as to which is your healthiest and which is your unhealthiest assets is incredibly important. So that'd be my takeaway. What's your takeaway here?
My takeaway on this is kind of goes back to visibility in general, right? Like we have a tendency to want to only highlight the good and not really recognize where things are going wrong. And scorecarding is one of those maturity activities that can expose what's really going on in an organization, right? So without any sort of flavor or without any sort of politics involved, you can get a good idea of where security actually exists and what your current maturity level is. But if you don't measure it, you're never going to get that, because you're always going to get that hand wavy. People don't want to give bad news. And so you've got to find a way to uncover where things are going wrong without, without attributing blame, right? Because no one wants to look bad to their boss. No one wants to look bad to the rest of the team. And this induces a certain level of, I don't want to say shame, but also, you know, shame without attributing blame and giving people the opportunity to improve themselves without too many consequences, I guess, right? But it does feel like a fine line to walk to me. So, I would be interested to hear how this is going for people, right? And how they actually do this sort of analysis, because a lot of organizations just have a tendency to put their head in the sand. They get their compliance check from their annual pen test, and then they move on, right? As opposed to actually digging into the security across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know, like, if, you know, this episode is like, you know, pessimistic, optimistic take on the industry at large, right? But yeah.
I don't have any feelings about it. We'll be here. We'll still be doing work. We'll still be talking about these things.
Yes, we always will be, right? Yeah.
And if you have need to, like, if you need emotional support or other types of emotional assistance, reach out to Seth directly via DM and only Seth will be happy to talk about those feelings.
Join our Slack community. We'll start a mental health channel where we talk about, you know, it's only pictures of cats and dogs. That'll be it, right?
Puppies and kittens.
Puppies and kittens, right? Like that will be the only feed. Yeah. Anyway, appreciate everyone. Join us in Slack. We'll continue the conversation there. Sign up for the newsletter if you haven't. We're starting to post the newsletter to Substack as well. I think we're going to start pushing that channel a little bit more, and happy to interact and see what everybody's doing and how you're staying sane and preventing burnout for yourself and in your organization. All right. Appreciate it, Ken. We will talk to everybody next week.
Thanks, everybody. All right.